Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway to celebrate with you this wonderful time of Thanksgiving and to count our many blessings together. It is so important that we do this because, as it says in the 8th chapter of Deuteronomy, we must never forget that these gifts come from God, and therefore we must always remember to thank Him for those blessings. We'll be joined in a couple of minutes by our old friend John Sloop and our guest to review America's godly heritage. Remember, so that we can give thanks. However, by way of background, Rita and I would like to review for you two Thanksgiving proclamations that were issued by two of our greatest presidents. And I hope you will be struck, as we were, by the repeated references they make to God throughout their proclamations. Rita, what's the first one?
Well, Dean, our very first federal proclamation was issued by President George Washington in 1789, in which he recognized God's hand on America during the War for Independence and in the creation of our national government. I won't read all of it, but as you said, nearly every sentence refers to God one or more times. 15 times altogether in just three short paragraphs. Washington begins this way, and I quote, "Whereas it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor. Let us all unite in rendering unto Him our sincere and humble thanks for His kind care and protection." And it goes on, "and for all the great and various favors which He has been pleased to confer upon us," end quote. That is so powerful, and I'd like to read the rest of it another time, but what's the second one, Dean?
Well, Rita, the next one is equally compelling, and again, we see these references to God. This one comes from President Abraham Lincoln in 1863, during the darkest days of the Civil War that was tearing our country apart. It was at that time when he might have felt like cursing God instead of being thankful to Him. However, once again, as was the case with Washington's proclamation that you just read, President Lincoln also repeatedly refers to God 8 times in just 4 short paragraphs. Even in the midst of that awful war, Lincoln said, and I quote, "We must recognize Almighty God as the source of all of our blessings. We must never forget His watchful providence. These great things are the gracious gifts of the Most High God." He goes on to say, quote, "We must now fervently implore the hand of the Almighty and His divine purposes to heal the wounds of the nation and to restore peace, harmony, tranquility, and union."
That's just beautiful. And what strikes me most about these two proclamations is their source. Two of the greatest presidents in America's history, looking to God in humility as the source of their blessings and calling on the nation to come together before Him in thanksgiving. I know we're going to get into this later in the program, but these presidential acts of public worship and thanksgiving are so refreshing in a day when public prayers and other religious expressions and monuments are wrongly attacked as a violation of the so-called separation of church and state. Now, we know that what our Constitution says about freedom of religion hasn't changed at all, but boy, has our culture changed.
It has changed a lot, Rita. And for further evidence of how it has changed, we need only to look at President Obama's proclamation just last year, which contained no reference to God at all. Instead, it's more of a litany of praise to the diversity and brotherhood of man rather than to God. It's a celebration of tolerance and inclusiveness rather than a prayer of humble penitence for our national perverseness and disobedience, as Lincoln also prayed. And that is why we need today to take the opportunity to give thanks to God for our many blessings, and to pray for another great awakening that will draw us back to Him instead of just focusing on ourselves. So, to do that, here's John Sloop to introduce the rest of our program and to welcome our special guest.
This morning, joining us by phone from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Stephen K. McDowell, author, teacher, lecturer, and I might even say movie producer, and nationally recognized authority on the subject of America's godly heritage. In fact, I'm holding in my hand right now a copy of one of Stephen's earliest books published in 1989 called America's Providential History. It's a primer on biblical principles of education, government, politics, economics, and family life. Stephen, I want you to know that your book has been foundational for my own understanding of the role of God's hand in the lives of our founding fathers. So, Stephen, welcome to Crossroads, and please get the conversation started by telling us a bit about your own personal story, how you got involved in this ministry, and what is the primary mission of the Providence Foundation, of which you are executive director.
Well, good morning, John and Rita and Dean. It's great to be with you. Thanks for inviting me to be part of the show. You know, it was actually in college, I studied the sciences, but during that time, God moved in my life, and so when I finished graduate school, I began to pastor churches, and during that time, I became interested in how the Bible applied not just to personal life, but to civil life, because the Bible speaks to all of life, and so to help train Christians in how to apply biblical principles to every sphere of life, I resigned my pastorate and helped start the Providence Foundation over 31 years ago. And our mission is to train and network leaders to transform their culture for Christ, to teach all citizens how to disciple the nations, which is what Christ said we're to do, which means not only to convert individuals, but to transform the society at large. And so I've been working ever since then. We've worked to train people from over 100 different countries how to apply biblical principles in their particular area of calling. We have our material translated into 18 languages, and we're doing all we can just to bring godly truth to bear in our society, to be salt and light, as we're called to do.
Well, you know, Stephen, this book that I'm holding right now, America's Providential History, would be a great text for a small group, for a Sunday school class, for even a pastor to preach through. And we're going to tell folks how to get in touch with your materials later on.
Well, you obviously have a great passion for making sure Americans remember, understand, and honor our nation's Judeo-Christian heritage. Why is that? Why is it so important that Americans do that?
You know, Rita, America has been the most free and prosperous nation the world has ever seen. We're unique in history. We're special. And that uniqueness, or exceptionalism, as we used to teach, isn't so much about the people themselves that gave birth to America, but it's the ideas that they carried with them, because ideas are like seed. And our great freedom and liberty and prosperity is a result of the ideas that they planted. And so we need to understand, what were those ideas? Where did those ideas come from? Because if we plant different seeds, we're going to get different fruit. And so when you look at our history and look at the things that motivated those who gave birth to the nation, they clearly proclaimed that biblical Christianity was the source, their character, their ideas, their motives. And so when they came and built this nation, they built their families, obviously their churches, but civil laws, economic systems, educational systems, upon the principles that they got out of the Bible. And so if we want to know where do we get this great fruit, we need to know where did the seed come from. And so it's essential for us to understand our true history if we want to be able to recognize what produced our great liberty and then enable us to preserve and pass it on to our children and their children.
Well, Stephen, you mentioned American exceptionalism, and I wonder if you could just narrow that down. What are some of these important themes and principles that draw from the Bible and that have made America such an exceptional nation?
Well, some of those exceptional ideas are the concept of the value of the individual, the importance of individual life, that all men are created equal, as our Declaration says, the concepts of freedom of worship, freedom of assembly, the opportunity for people to labor and benefit from the fruit of their labor, the freedom people have to elect representatives and have a voice in their government, the freedom of thought and expression of ideas, the freedom to own property, freedom to get ideas, start business, create wealth, even the whole concept of limited jurisdiction of civil government was unique in history, and that we all have equal standing before the law. There's no class distinction, the central role of the family. Those are some of those important ideas, all of which came from the Bible, that were unique. You have to realize that most nations throughout all of history did not apply those ideas or believe those ideas, and they're cut off primarily from the source of those ideas, the Bible. And those are some of the things that made us exceptional, gave us an unmatched liberty, exceptional form of government, exceptional prosperity and fruits and other things.
You know, it's so interesting to hear you describe those exceptional American principles. I just asked you a minute ago, why is it so important for America to remember those founding principles? And as I hear you describe them, for instance, the role of government, which is limited, the role of civil government, and the role of the family, on the other hand. And as I think about the decline of our nation and all the problems we have today, what I see is that all of those problems are linked to the fact that people don't seem to be remembering or really understanding those principles anymore. So your organization has a big mission and a big job today.
Well, Stephen, also just following up on that, a lot of people really take exception to this reference to America as an exceptional nation. But I guess a follow-on question would be, would it be accurate, and maybe this you've already answered this, is it accurate to refer to America as a Christian nation?
Well, certainly it was. You know, our founders themselves said we were a Christian nation over and over and over. Of course, you have to define what you mean by a Christian nation. To me, when I use the phrase Christian nation, I mean founded upon Christian principles.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Every nation is founded upon a set of principles that are ultimately rooted in the faith of the people. This is an inescapable concept of the religious foundation of every nation. So today we're trying to say, oh, you've got to be neutral in regards to faith. That's an impossibility. But America was founded upon biblical ideas. And so that is what makes it a Christian nation. Our civil laws are built upon principles out of the Bible. Our moral laws are built upon the principles of the Ten Commandments, our educational institutions, our family, economic institutions. And as I said, because of this, the founders, as we were a Christian nation, our first Chief Justice, John Jay, he's the first Supreme Court Chief Justice appointed by George Washington, but he said providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and it is the duty as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers.
I'm just reading from your book where you quote the 19th century statesman and politician Daniel Webster, who said this: "If we and our posterity shall be true to the Christian religion, if we and they shall live always in the fear of God and shall respect His commandments, may we have the highest hopes of the future fortunes of our country. But if we and our posterity neglect religious instruction and authority, violate the rules of eternal justice, trifle with the injunctions of morality, and recklessly destroy the political constitution which holds us together, no man can tell how sudden a catastrophe may overwhelm us that shall bury all our glory in profound obscurity." Now, it seems to me, Stephen, that Daniel Webster's prophecy has been fulfilled. Tell us, as a historian, at what point in our history did we begin to see this shift away from those Judeo-Christian values and constitutional principles, and in what specific ways has that drift taken place?
Well, it's been a gradual thing. There's a gradual rise of secularism in America. We see a rise of secularism in the church beginning in the first part of the 1800s with a move toward Unitarianism and putting aside the knowledge of the Trinity. We see a rise of secularism in education with Horace Mann in the 1830s, 40s, when he set up a state system of education, first in Massachusetts, where state-controlled and state-compelled education followed along those. We see a rise of secularism in law at Harvard Law School in the late 1800s, but I think this was depicted well in 1920s when Roscoe Pound became the president of Harvard Law School. He recognized the Christian foundation of law in America, and he didn't attack it. He said, hey, you know, it's been good. It brought us to this point in our nation. We've advanced, but, he said, we can't continue forward on this same foundation. We need a different foundation. And so he suggested the new foundation of law not be the absolutes of God's law, who gave birth to the nation, our civil laws were built upon. But he said, let the consensus of man determine what law will be from now on. And in his book, The Spirit of Common Law, he gives this quote. He said, in this situation, quote, the state takes the place of Jehovah.
Wow.
And so we see, because of the rise of secularism in education and in some churches, we begin to fail to teach this absolute concept of law, God's higher law. Any law contrary to that law is no law at all. And so then that began to be taught in our law schools, for example. And we picked up this idea that we accept today of evolutionary law. Laws changing as the thoughts of man change, or judges and legislators change, or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. Those are just a few things.
Stephen, could I just add to that? You mentioned law schools, but I think in some of your writings you mentioned a shift away in our seminaries, too, where instead of religion and morality infiltrating the entire curriculum, they set aside specific divinity schools so it became separate from our culture.
Yeah, and that was really the seed, as I mentioned, that rise of secularism in the church and the way that we train ministers. You know, to me, that's really the key point of why we've slipped away from our Christian roots, is the church has failed to be the church. The church has failed to uphold the great doctrines of the lordship of Christ, the sovereignty of God, the providence of God. And if you don't adhere to that, then you're going to gradually decay in every other area, as we've seen that take place.
Well, you know, I'm sure you are familiar with, as I am, lots of Americans today who don't even see the value in talking about or thinking about whatever our heritage is. And those Americans would say, for instance, who cares whether the founding fathers were Christians or not? And who cares what the original meaning of the Constitution was? Because all of that is outdated. We have to change with the time. So let's just move on and conform things in America today to what's popular and what most people believe today. How would you respond to them?
Well, it's always the nature of tyrants to keep people ignorant. our founders knew that. You know, Jefferson said to expect to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization is what never has been or will be. Because it's in the region of ignorance that tyranny begins, as Benjamin Franklin said. And so, if we are ignorant of, but ignorance is not just being able to read and write or add numbers together, it's ignorance of how to live free. You know, the default state of fallen man is not to live in liberty. It's hard to live free. Mm-hmm. And so to live free, we have to have character, comes out of the Bible, and we have to have a worldview, an understanding of life, the nature of man, the nature of government, the nature of how things work, the morality. And this requires education. You know, Jesus said we disciple nations by teaching them to observe all that I commanded. So teaching is an integral part of transforming men and nations. We have to teach truth. And so, you know, I think one of the major factors in secularization accompanying the decline of the church is the state control of education. You know, whoever controls children controls the future.
Yeah.
And so as you move into the late 1800s and throughout the 20th century, we have a state-compelled, state-controlled, state-taxed form of education, and you have to realize all education is religious. So we really today have a state-controlled religion when we have state-controlled education. Or G.K. Chesterton put it this way, about the same time the Western world put off the idea of compelling in religion, they picked up the idea of compelling in education.
Mm-hmm.
Since education is religious, we are actually compelling in fundamental beliefs of what's right and wrong, truthful, moral, etc. And so those who control education then control the worldview of the American people. And that worldview does not teach people to live free, but teaches them to live socialistically.
Stephen, it's interesting because you were talking about the late 1800s and the state superintendent for education in Kansas, you may recall, said at one point, if we remove the Bible and religious education from our public government schools, it would be better if they returned education control to the churches. And that's, I think, exactly what you're saying. But Stephen, against this background of increasing secularization, secularism, socialism, whatever, government control, some people believe that we have passed the point of no return as a Christian nation. For example, as with Ben Franklin, when he was wondering whether the sun was rising or setting on America. How do you see that today? Is it rising or setting?
Well, some of that depends upon God's grace and how we fulfill our duties. John Quincy Adams said, duty is ours, the results are the Lord's.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to look around and say, are God's people awake and working? And there is good news, because there are millions of God's people awake, working, they're assuming their responsibility of training their children, for example, in home education. There's 3 to 4 million homeschoolers today.
Mm.
There's 10 or 15,000 in the late 70s. There's a lot of people working, and like, you know, the family, your organization there in the valley to bring godly values and ideas to the people. There are godly people getting involved in government. There are a lot of people doing things, but there's not enough. So I have hope, because I do look around and all aren't dead, all aren't asleep. That does give me hope, but I'm very much aware of the great amount of thorns and thistles that are growing and the great assault against our founding principles that we see taking place today. And this gives me some concern. So, you know, I have hope, but I'm very much concerned. So we need to pray, we need to act, we need to do all that the Bible tells us is our responsibility to do if we hope to see the nation turned around.
Stephen, I like your phrase about, you know, God's people being awake and working. And then you also talked about thorns and thistles. It reminds me of Jesus' parable, you know, where he said, while men were sleeping. And we've already referred to it earlier that the church has been asleep, and the church's responsibility in all this is very, very significant. So help us, Stephen. What can help ignite the church? What can ignite another great awakening to restore America to its Judeo-Christian roots and constitutional principles?
Well, there are certainly four duties we have biblically. One is prayer. We know the importance of prayer, the foundation of any of our action. And there's evangelism. We need to teach truth to the heart of men so they might encounter the true and living God. Because all change begins in the heart of man, and only the God of the Bible can supernaturally change people. So obviously that's our only ultimate solution to what's going on. Third is education, as we talked a little bit about before. We've got to be knowledgeable of all he commanded, not just part of it. And then fourth, and if we do the first three, four should follow, is action. Let's apply the things that we know, you know, go out and be that salt and light. So that prayer, evangelism, education, and action, the practical steps that we take, and of course that action is in every sphere of life. Early Americans recognized that, and they literally discipled the nation. They trained people to get involved in government and create new inventions and technology and transform medicine and every area of life, they acted upon that biblical concept of vocation. So those are just four general things we can do.
Stephen, those are all helpful and practical. In your work, do you see a trend or a pattern among the clergy? I talk to so many clergy who seem to have bought in to what I consider to be the lie of this, the separation of church and state. And I hear it over and over again, you know, I shouldn't be involved in politics. I shouldn't preach from the pulpit, these kinds of subjects. So how do we get pastors and churches to implement these four steps that you've just outlined?
Well, we have a free course to pastors on our website called Watchmen on the Walls, and it deals with pastors equipping Christians for their civil duties. We have civil duties. That's one things Jesus taught us. So I could point people, especially ministers, to that, and they can go through that free. And in depth answers that question. But, I love to look at the founders of America. John Adams was once asked, well, who were the founding fathers of America? And he began to list a bunch of ministers, Reverend Jonathan Mayer, Reverend Samuel Cooper, and John Witherspoon is one of those early pastors. He was the president of College in New Jersey, we now know as Princeton University, came over from Scotland, and during his tenure, and Princeton was a whole lot different than today, but during his tenure, he trained one president, one vice president, three Supreme Court justices, 10 governors, 12 cabinet members, 60 congressmen.
Wow.
That's one-fifth of the signers of the Declaration, one-sixth of the members of the Constitutional Convention, and one-fifth of the members of the First Congress that met in 1789 were trained by John Witherspoon.
He had an impact, I'd say.
He discipled the nation. That's what we need to be doing today, the church.
Yeah, I just want to say again the name of that course for pastors. It's called Watchmen on the Walls. And I know
Watchmen on the Walls.
Yep, and it says, pastors equipping Christians for their civil duties. And I know we're going to give you a chance in just a minute to tell our listeners about your website and where they can find more information.
Stephen, before we run out of time, I do want to give you an opportunity. How can our listeners find out more about the Providence Foundation, some of your resources, and how to contact you for information?
Well, our website is providencefoundation.com. That's all run together, providencefoundation.com. We have many, many books and training courses. We have that course that's free to pastors, Watchmen on the Walls. That's, of course, cheap and available to anyone to pay as well. You mentioned earlier America's Providential History, lots of churches and groups.
Thank you, Stephen. I think we just have to suggest to our listeners just to go to your website, get on the links to your resources, and there's just so much there. So I'll just turn this over to John to close us out.
Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today. We'd love to have you back again, and next time maybe drive over and join us in the studio. What an informative and inspiring program we've had today. And the Crossroads team, Dean, Rita, and I, we want to continue bringing the Valley this kind of program. You're not going to find this anywhere else. But we really need you to help us financially to support this ministry, to stay on this station and three others. If you tune in regularly to Crossroads, and if you are thankful for this ministry, then please, today, write us a check and mail it to Crossroads, P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, Virginia, 22803. And so, till next week, this is John Sloop for Rita Dunaway and Dean Welty, encouraging you to be salt and light, to make a difference for Christ at the Crossroads, where faith and culture meet.
Rejoice, 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 rej